Light and sound from all, and dwellers in each room should have the right to choose their own design and color schemes to suit their own, though differing from mine. Yes, and each door has its own design to suit the owner's state of mind, and those who'd want them all the same don't understand the human game. My father's mansion's many rooms have room for all of his children if we do but share in his love and see that all are free. The choice is ours to share this earth with all its many joys abound, or continue as we have and burn God's mansion down. My father's mansion's many rooms have room for all of his children if we do but share in his love and see that all are free.
Very nice. Thank you, Silent Bear. Fergus, what's your next choice?
Well, I have a song called Oh, Had I a Rainbow Thread. Pete, I think most people know he was not television's favorite entertainer. He had a very hard time getting on TV because TV knew they couldn't control him. They couldn't buy him off with luxury. He was going to be his own man, and that was unacceptable to them. But finally, in 1965 to 66, he got one season of his own program called Rainbow Quest on National Educational Television, which was the forerunner of PBS. And this is the tune he played to start each program. He had lots of people on it, other guests, including bluegrass bands. And Silent Bear and I were just talking. He had Johnny Cash on one day. Hmm. And Johnny said, would you play a song on the fretless banjo I gave you? And, of course, he did. It was that kind of folksy, low-key show. This was his opening tune.
Stretch my magic band
to every city in every single land, in every land. In it I would weave the restlessness of men going ever far, through blistering heat of desert sands and blizzards of the north, through the frozen north. Show my brothers and my sisters my rainbow design. He bind up this sorry world with hand and heart and mind, and heart and mind. Far over the waters, I'd reach my magic band to every human being, so they understand, so they understand. So fine, I'd weave a magic band of rainbow design, of rainbow design.
Thank you, Fergus. And before we bring Elena Claver on, I just want to make note that it is 8:07, and this is KJNU Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins. My name is Will Two-Step, and normally this is the slot that Jack Rummel's Ragtime America program would be normally scheduled, but Jack was very kind and gave up his hour this week to help us celebrate Pete Seeger's birthday, which is tomorrow. Thanks again, Jack, and we apologize if anybody's disappointed that the Ragtime show is not on, but we're going to have a little bit more Pete, and then Jack will be back next week. So, Elena, what's your tune?
Well, it's a medley of two songs from the Spanish Civil War, and I never learned about the Spanish Civil War in high school or college. I learned about it from a really amazing recording, an LP, that Pete was one of the musicians on, and there were songs in all these different languages about the Spanish Civil War, and that got me kind of interested as to why I'd never learned about it, and I ended up reading a book about it and meeting Milt Wolf, the last commander of the Lincoln Brigade, and found out that my high school math teacher was in, her husband was in the Lincoln Brigade. But when I heard these songs, I just thought that Pete did him really well on the banjo, and I didn't learn banjo from Pete Seeger. I learned kind of old-time style, but anyway, these are Si Me Quieres Escribir and Viva la Quince Brigada, and the Quince Brigada was the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. So...
Si me quieres escribir, ya sabes mi paradero. Si me quieres escribir, ya sabes mi paradero, en el frente de Gandesa, primera línea del fuego. En el frente de Gandesa, primera línea del fuego. Si tú quieres comer bien barato y de buena forma, si tú quieres comer bien barato y de buena forma, en el frente de Gandesa, ahí tienen una fonda. En el frente casa allí tienen una fonda. En la entrada de la fonda hay un moro Mohamed. En la entrada de la fonda hay un moro Mohamed que te dice pasa, pasa, ¿qué quieres para comer? Pasa, pasa, ¿qué quieres para comer? El primer plato que dan son granadas rompedoras. El primer plato que dan son granadas rompedoras. El segundo de metralla para recordar memorias. El segundo de metralla para recordar memorias. Viva la quince brigada, rumba, rumba, rumbala. Viva la quince brigada, rumba, rumba, rumbala. Que sea cubierta gloria, Emanuela, Emanuela. Que sea cubierta gloria, Emanuela, Emanuela. Frentes de Jarama, rumba, rumba, rumbala. No tenemos ni aviones ni cañones, ay, Manuela. No tenemos ni aviones ni cañones, ay, Manuela. Luchamos contra los moros, rumba, rumba, rumbala. Luchamos contra los moros, rumba, rumba, rumbala. Mercenarios y fascistas, ay, Manuela, ay, Manuela. Mercenarios y fascistas, ay, Manuela, ay, Manuela. Ya salimos de España, rumba, rumba, rumbala. Ya salimos de España, rumba, rumba, rumbala. Para luchar en otros frentes, ay, Manuela, ay, Manuela. Para luchar en otros frentes, ay, Manuela, ay, Manuela. Brigada, rumba, rumba, rumbala. Viva la quince brigada, rumba, rumba, rumbala. Que continúa la lucha, Emanuela, Emanuela. Que continúa la lucha, Emanuela, Emanuela.
Very nice, Elena. Thank you. All right, let's get the three of you guys back up there. Fergus Stone, Silent Bear, and Elena Claver. And what's the name of this tune, and why'd you guys pick this one?
Well, this one is, we could call it Pete's Prayer for the Earth and the Human Race. Mm-hmm. It's simply called Well May the World Go.
Very good.
Swinging round and around when I'm far away. Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away. from far away. Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away.
So, Tina, a lot of people know about your dad, Pete Seeger, but not that many people know about your mom. Could you talk about Toshi and their work together, how they worked as a team, or how she helped him do what he did?
Oh, sure. I think I could go all the way back to when they met, which was the first time she caught a sight of him, or caught his eye, or he caught her eye, was when she was working at the New York World's Fair. She was working in the Japanese Pavilion, and he was just a helper there, unloading cars, helping people set up, and mostly he picked litter. And I guess I mentioned that because years down the road, he's still picking litter. And at the festivals, my mom started what is now called zero waste, but it was what she called litter picking. And it was about a festival or any event going in and out of the park or the area and leaving it even better than it was before they had it. And so they had t-shirts printed up with this, and I always found it like that's where it started years ago. She just saw this kid, you know, 19 years old, and she's 16. She sees him picking up litter, and from there they met a few times, and she worked for him shortly after. He needed some office help for the Almanac Singers and asked if she said she could probably help sort out some of his piles of papers and help with the typing, and you know, things went from there. So I would say they had a working relationship in a way right from the start.
Please keep talking about that, and because they really did work as a team over their very, very long marriage. And there were, of course, difficulties, like when your father was blacklisted because of his son not testifying. It's a family life. It's also she helped him really contribute so much to so many people. And I think she's less known than him, so that's why it's nice to hear you talk about him.
Yeah,
her.
So like that's it. They started out as a working relationship when she was 16, just working. And, of course, they fell in love, and he goes off in the Army, and they got married when he was on a furlough, I think. And they continued. Really, she was very supportive of his projects and ideas. I wouldn't say they were his after a while. They were their projects, and they agreed on most things, sometimes one or the other one of them might have initiated things. So he was equally supportive, but in these days, the way it is, often if there has to be a compromise, and this is a relationship, she often gave up her personal projects and things for his, but she believed in his as well. So it wasn't something that was a problem, except that I know as a woman, she might like to have pursued some of her things sometimes. She was very gracious about it. She just was a person that she protected him a lot from not just the public, but from overwork, and saw that he was well taken care of. She pushed him at times, too. I can remember him being sick, like having his throat wrapped up and writing messages to us. We couldn't talk because he was saving his voice, and yet she would push him to perform anyway. He never was a no-show at a concert, even when he was sick. One way or another, if he had to get up on stage and tell the audience to sing for him and play the banjo, he did it. He didn't stay home because he was sick. There were times when we traveled around the world for 10 months. He had a concert every day and sometimes more than one a day. It was hard to do that many all at once, and it was concentrated into certain months because we went to Japan where he could earn a little bit of money to pay for the tour. And then, of course, there'd be some weeks in between where we were mostly with my mom was a filmmaker, too, and he would do the interviewing, and she would handle the camera. My brother and sister would handle the sound. And we traveled for 10 months, but she arranged that whole trip. She would see that we, you know, nobody got lost, no luggage got lost. She had all the visas in line, and knew where we were staying. She was very good at road management for my father. And Harold Leventhal was at the office in New York and managed their other stuff at home. But when we were gone, she could keep everything together from the business part to the family part. you know, and that's not easy when you're in 27 countries in 10 months and don't speak the language most of the time. We all were amazed. She seemed to be able to always just get along with everybody. And it was as if she could speak the language of the country because she used her eyes and her hands and her friendliness, you know, and her ability to get along with Bull and just make them feel comfortable with her and her comfortable with them, that we could travel in countries as if we weren't tourists. We didn't feel, we would talk about tourists as if those were somebody else. It wasn't us, because she had a way of just somehow making things work. So she supported him in every way possible, and they had many projects. One of them was community festivals. In a day when there really weren't a lot of community festivals in Hudson Valley, they planned, after the Clearwater was built, to have the boat stop at all the towns up and down the river and give free festivals. She would bring along a huge stone soup pot, must have held 30 gallons, build a fire with driftwood, and people would come by with food, and she'd cook it and then serve stone soup at the end of the day. And there would be music on shore, and it was all free. The basic idea was that the Hudson was filthy at that time, before gentrification and people realizing it was beautiful along the river to live. It was there, you know, it was for industry to dump their stuff in. And it wasn't being valued the way it should be, and people didn't really know how beautiful it was. So his idea was, let's get people down to the river. They'll see how gorgeous it is. And I'm not saying nobody was down at the river. I'm saying, obviously, the people with money weren't down at the river. There was, of course, a community at the river. But he was trying to get the politicians and the people that would clean up the towns and everybody down there and have people realize that this is worth cleaning up, that everybody could be enjoying it and swimming in it.
I'd also like to ask you, your mom was Japanese-American at a time in U.S. history when it was very difficult. Do you think that her experience helped inform his views on oppression and repression of minority populations?
I do. I think for her, growing up in the Depression, pretty much hand-to-mouth, that her parents were, because her father had trouble getting work as a Japanese man in the 1920s and 30s. In fact, moved into the theater and the theater world around Greenwich Village because that was a more accepting place for him to work. He didn't want to just be doing jobs that were not creative. And so she grew up in a world that was very creative, and her father was painting the sex with the theaters and things. And it didn't mean they had a lot of money, though. And so they lived in places for free that were owned by people that had two houses often. So in the wintertime, she grew up in Woodstock, New York, in the houses of artists that were in the city for the winter. And in the summer, vice versa, they might go out to the country and she might stay in the city with her family. And that wasn't like they were homeless, but of course they weren't paying rent and they had found a way to make do. And this worked for her whole childhood up until age 12 when they finally settled in and she started going to school in New York City. So she had a different upbringing than he did, which was more in when his parents lived together till he was 8, they got divorced and he grew up in boarding schools and in the summer camped out in the country with his father in a barn. So they both were used to unusual places to live and ways of making do. My father traveled in a little trailer as a baby with his parents, a handmade trailer, and they traveled to the South, and his parents were giving musical concerts on people's fields in the, you know, and in little towns, they were classical musicians. My mother experienced poverty, though, more than he did. She took care of the finances. She just saw that everything worked out. He only had work on the music. He didn't have to worry about a lot of things because he had her to worry about it for him. So I think that's one of the many things she did, is she relieved him of a lot of the day-to-day and allowed him to have the free time that allows a person to be creative.
Well, Tina, thank you so much for sharing this memory about your mom and your dad.
You're welcome.
Well, what shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? I'll lie in the morning. Way, hey, up she rises. Way, hey, up she rises. Way, hey, up she rises. I'll lie in the morning. Throw him in the longboat till he's sober. Put him in the longboat till he's sober. Put him in the longboat till he's sober. I'll lie in the morning. Way, hey, up she rises. Way, hey, up she rises. Way, hey. Thank you.
scuppers with a hose pipe on him. Put him in the scuppers with a hose pipe on him. Put him in the scuppers with a hose pipe on him. Merle in the morning. Way up she rises, way up she rises, way up she rises. Merle in the morning. Climb to the Taffel Ringy's yard on Monday. Climb to the Taffel Ringy's yard on Monday. Climb to the Taffel Ringy's yard on Monday. Shave his belly with a rusty razor. Shave his belly with a rusty razor. Her lie in the morning. Away up she rises. Way up she rises. Way up she rises. Her lie in the morning. Way up she rises. Way up she rises. Way up she rises. Her lie in the morning.
There's a hole in the bucket, dear Liza, dear Liza. There's a hole in the bucket, dear Liza, there's a hole. Then fix it, dear Willie, dear Willie, dear Willie. Then fix it, dear Willie, fix it. With what shall I fix it, dear Liza, with what shall I fix it, dear Liza, with what? With straw, dear Willie, dear Willie, dear Willie, with straw, dear Willie, with straw. But how shall I cut it, dear Liza, but how shall I cut it, dear Liza, just how? With a knife, dear Willie, dear Willie, dear Willie, with a knife, dear Willie, with a knife. But the knife needs sharpening, dear Liza, the knife needs sharpening, dear Liza, needs sharpening. Then sharpen it, dear Willie, dear Willie, dear Willie, then sharpen it, dear Willie, then sharpen it. With what shall I sharpen it, dear Liza, with what shall I sharpen it, dear Liza, with what? With a stone, dear Willie, dear Willie, dear Willie, with a stone, dear Willie, with a stone. But the stone needs water, dear Liza, the stone needs water, dear Liza needs water. Then fetch it, dear Willie, dear Willie, dear Willie, then fetch it, dear Willie, fetch it. With what shall I fetch it, dear Liza, with what shall I fetch it, dear Liza, with what? In a bucket, dear Willie, dear Willie, dear Willie, in a bucket, dear Willie, in a bucket. There's a hole in the bucket, dear Liza, there's a hole in the bucket, dear Liza, there's a hole.
Thank you.
I live in that city that is built amongst the hills, where smoke is always pouring from the big rolling mills, and steamboats on the rivers go towing to and fro, where the old Allegheny and Monongahela flow.
The time is 8:32. My name is Will Two-Step, and this is KGNU Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins, your community radio station. This is a special edition of Highway 322. We're now into the hour that normally is Ragtime America, and thank you, Jack. Jack gave us an extra hour so we can celebrate Pete's music for you. I had a few phone calls, and people seem to be enjoying the live music and the recordings. Thank you very much, everybody. And we just ended that set there with Where the Old Allegheny and the Monongahela Flow. That was, of course, by Pete. And then Hole in the Bucket, and started that short little set off with What Shall We Do with a Drunken Sailor. And now I'd like to introduce Mr. Dean Birkenkamp again. Dean, what do you have for us in sharing?
Thank you, Will. Well, this is another letter that was published in the book Pete Seeger in His Own Words, which I worked on with Pete and two other collaborators for several years in the later part of his life. This letter was very special in two ways. One, Pete had forgotten all about it, and nobody had ever read it before. And it was found in his barn and brought up to the house, and Pete didn't remember the letter or know what it was. And on the front of the letter, it said, "Not to be open until after death of my father and Peter Seeger, or around the year 2000 A.D. I guess he expected to live to the age 80. Anyway, it's special for another reason, in that it's written at a crucial moment in Americans' feelings about communism, including by the left, because it was 1956, and the deeds of Stalin in Ukraine and otherwise were becoming known. So, here's the letter from Pete, and I'm going to read excerpts. It's a long letter, but I'm going to try to get to the essence. Dear descendants, I write this in the 38th year of my life to try and give a few unvarnished facts in case some of you ever get curious as to who or what this character, namely me, is. First, you have to understand that this mid-20th century has been torn by fears, doubts, confusions, and arguments about such things as peace and civil rights and so on. Central in all these matters has been a much-discussed word, communism. Some say communism means tyranny over mind and body. They say that under communism one has no political democracy, and that people can be railroaded to jail for simply disagreeing with those in power. Communists in America always denied this. They said that, on the contrary, here in the good old U.S., people were often railroaded to jail just because they disagreed with those in power. But now, in this year, 1956, it appears by admission of the Russians themselves that all was, and possibly is not, as sweet as American communists hoped. I joined the Young Communist League in the fall of 1937, when I was 18 years old, and a student at Harvard. Prior to that, I had read a few radical publications, such as New Masses. A few years later, I graduated up to the real Communist Party and have been, according to my own definition, a communist ever since. Not that I went to meetings often, because so much of my life has been traveling. At times, I attended no communist meeting at all, and even dues paying was irregular, to say the least. By that definition, I've been a very poor communist. I say that probably in the last 25 years, I've attended perhaps 50 meetings in all. Oy. I said, according to my own definition. What is my definition? Well, if you ask, am I in favor of slave labor camps or stifling of opinion or violent revolution, I say no. If you ask, am I in favor of cooperative ownership and planning production and consumption? And do I believe that only under such socialism will eventually wars cease and arts and science truly flourish? Then I say, you bet. I feel that far from holding any tyranny over my mind, communism has urged me on to continually learn, to better myself in every way, to always give more for the common good of the working people of America and the world. Perhaps all of this sounds a little corny to you, or has the ring of ancient history. Well, please know at this time it is almost life and death matter for many of us. At this time, I am cited for contempt of Congress and may go to jail. We will see what that future brings. Your loving grandfather, Peter Seeger.
Thank you, Dean. That was very nice, and thank you for sharing that. Fantastic. All right, let's get back to the cabaret room for some more live music. We're going to have one more round, not round, but we're going to have one group tune here. Let me get the cabaret room going. And again, this is KJNU Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins on a Thursday night, a special Pete Seeger 100th anniversary. Jack Rummel will be back next week. So what's the next tune, guys?
Well, this one's from about 1951. It's another Pete Seeger and Lee Hayes collaboration. Pete found the words in the typewriter one morning and came up with this music. It's called If I Had a Hammer, or otherwise known as the Hammer Song. It was a really powerful one in about 1951, so powerful that sometimes they wouldn't do it because the manager figured they'd make too many enemies. It kind of put the world on notice. And we're going to give it all we've got. And I also want to join my voice to yours thanking Jack Rummel for surrendering time so that we might have a fuller appreciation of Pete. Jack, many people don't know, is a terrific banjo player himself, and not only that, a composer. Mm-hmm. He composed an original rag for the five string and published it in a nationally circulated magazine. So he's a real guy, and he was only, I would say, too happy to help us out with this. He's been very gracious. So thanks, Jack. And thanks to you, Jack. Will, for a nice show. Here we go. Come on, we'll get it. If I had a hammer, I'd ring it in the morning. Ring it in the evening. All over this land. I'd ring it in the morning.
Thank you very much, folks. That's Silent Bear, Fergus Stone, and Elena Claver playing live in the Cabaret Room, celebrating Pete Seeger's 100th birthday. Thanks a lot, guys. And we're going to finish this hour out here. We've got a quick little interview with David Amaran, and then we're going to have some more recorded music. And then at 9 o'clock, a swing shift will start with Tanya. So stay tuned.
David Amram is a multi-instrumentalist, a composer in many genres, and has had a life as colored, as storied, and as broad as Pete Seeger, with whom you've had such a long association. Can you talk a little bit about your long, long friendship, and also how you best think people can honor Pete's legacy?
Well, I met Pete Seeger in 1948. He was at a Henry Wallace rally. Henry Wallace was someone who had been... I believe a vice president, or he's running for vice president with Roosevelt, and I guess at that time was considered by the Democratic Party to be too progressive, or whatever you want to call it, to be a candidate at that particular time. So he decided to run on his own, and he also played the guitar and sang. He was a fantastic person. And my mother took me to this rally, and I saw this guy playing this weird instrument, and I said, "What's that that he's playing?" She said, "That's a banjo." I never seen a banjo. Then when the Henry Wallace speech was over, the banjo player ran out in the audience and started hanging out with everybody and still playing the banjo. I said, "Boy, I've got to meet that guy." And that guy was Pete Seeger. And I knew him and his wife Toshi from that point on until the day that he passed away. I went to the hospital. I was invited by a neighbor who's a good friend of their family's, which I was too, and they said they wanted us to come down. And Guy Davis Jr. and Pat Humphreys and myself all went down to the hospital to spend his last few hours with us playing music for him. He was an extraordinary person on so many levels, and much more than the branding of him, which came about. As everyone, I'm sure your audience knows, he was on a hit record, or two hit records in the 1940s, when that was really a big deal, and was playing all over the country with the Weavers, and suddenly they were blacklisted, and he couldn't get any work, and all of his work stopped, and he just continued doing what he was doing, and started going to summer camps and public schools, because that was the only place that he was able to work. He was, because of the blacklist, he was barred from being on the radio or playing any of the big concert halls. And it just didn't faze him at all. He just continued just what he was doing, as he had before he got blacklisted. And interestingly enough, it was Woody Guthrie from Okemo, Oklahoma, who met Pete Seeger, a Mayflower descendant who was going to Harvard. And Pete loved him so much, he dropped out of Harvard and went into the world that Woody introduced him to, traveling all over America and becoming interested in global folklore music, and was an extraordinary person. It was interesting because I just finished a new symphonic work called Partners, and I just had each movement for two partners, and the first set of partners were Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie. Second were Billie Holiday and Lester Young, and the third, Machito and Celia Cruz. I knew all six of those people, and Pete and Woody, just like Lester Young and Billie Holiday and beautiful Machito and Celia Cruz, were all people who brought so much cultural richness to the world and to America, and made a lot of people in this country see all the beautiful things that we have through music of the people who've come over here. And it was interesting how Pete thought about what we today would say were immigrants. We all know Woody's great song about deportees, but Pete always commented on how he felt grateful that his antecedents, who came with the Mayflower, when they arrived here, were treated with respect and welcoming by the Native American people. And none of them, to his knowledge, ever said to the people who were arriving here on these shores, fleeing from what they felt was an oppressive society, what religion they were, what their politics were. They were just welcomed, and they were welcomed and got through that first severe winter and were shown how to plant crops and how to be here. He said what we did after that to the Indian or Native people was disgraceful, but he said the most important thing, which I think would be of interest to your listeners, feeling guilty is a self-indulgence and a waste of time, but saying thank you in some small way and trying to be gracious to other people who are coming or came after you from another place to here and are still coming, just doing anything in the way of thanking you or continuing that spirit of thanks to those who welcomed his forebearers was very important. Just even a tiny thing, even just thinking about it, for starters. He was pretty remarkable. One time we were driving, and he went by the place where, in Peekskill, where he had been, had stones thrown at him and almost killed him and his family when they had the famous riots when Paul Rosen was singing so long ago. And he said, you know, he said, I bear no ill will towards Senator McCarthy or the House of Un-American Activities Committee. He said, those people did what they thought was right, and I did what I thought was right, and I'm proud that I did. And at the very end of his life, when people were asking him to do stuff, he said, you know, I can't sing that much anymore, and my health isn't that great, and my wife Toshi, who's been with me almost 70 years, is not in good health, and I try to look after her. Occasionally, I go into the public schools here where I live in Beacon and do stuff for kids. He said, but mostly, I just spend trying to take care of my family, and I spend the rest of the time that I have with people with whom I do not agree, and I recommend you all do the same. He was a very big person, and he definitely did not follow the Hillary Clinton maxim of 40 million deplorables. I never heard him insult anybody en masse of any group of people. He thought that music should bring people together, and I feel the same way. And it's non-sectarian. It's above. It transcends politics, and it transcends taking sides, and it transcends being a bigot in any way of anybody, and to be include all people as being part of the human experience. He's a pretty terrific guy, and I'm so glad that he's being honored. And I'll never forget, he came over to the little farm where I was living in Putnam Valley at that time with his wife Toshi just to visit, and Toshi got a phone call, and she said, Pops, which she used to call him affectionately, you got to get yourself a tuxedo now. And he said, why? And he said, because you've just been invited by the Kennedy Center to receive a presidential award. He said, oh my goodness. He said, I've spent my whole life fighting the establishment, and now I'm becoming one of them. I said, Pete, man, I said, you're getting what you deserve from all of America for all that you've given to all of America for so many generations. And I remember seeing him and his grandson, Tao, and Bruce Springsteen when they were all together singing This Land Is Your Land. Probably a billion people saw that on television all over the world. It was so nice to see him finally get his day. And now in Beacon, where I live after I moved from our farm, place in the stores which 40, 50 years ago wouldn't even serve him because they thought he and his wife were going to overthrow the government with his banjo. Now he's a local hero because the river, the Hudson River, you can go swimming in, you can go fishing, and it's safe to be there again. So even now the most arch-conservative people can go fishing and their kids can go swimming, and they realize it was Pete Seeger who thought this crazy idea of trying to clean up the river. So it's really nice to see sometimes that after a period of time, if you're really sincere, something good can come out of it.
Well, David, thank you so much. And Pete was a legend. You're a legend. And I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us about him.
Well, it's my treat. And thank you, and my blessings to everybody in Boulder. Thank you for your radio station showing that radio can be designed to uplift people and spread good information. Red, yellow, and white. Bring him home.
for Leonard Peltier. Bring him home, bring him home.
Yep, you got a lot of good words there.
Have you heard the latest of the song about that little boll weevil? He done been here and gone, looking for a home, looking for a home. The boll weevil, he's a little black bug from Mexico, they say. Came all the way to Texas, looking for a place to stay, looking for a home, just looking for a home, home, home. Looking for a home, just looking for a home. Now the first time I seen the boll weevil, he was sitting on the square. Next time I seen the boll weevil, he had his whole damn family there. He's looking for a home, he's looking for a home, home, home. Looking for a home, he's looking for a home. Well, the farmer took the boll weevil, he put him in a cake of ice. The boll weevil said to the farmer, this is mighty cool and nice. This'll be my home, this'll be my home. Now the farmer took the boll weevil and he put him in the hot sand. Boll weevil said, this is mighty hot, but I'll stand it like a man. Be my home, it'll be my home, 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 it'll be my home, it'll be my home. The boll weevil said to the farmer, you better leave me alone. I ate all your cotton, now I'm gonna start in on your corn. I'm looking for a home, I'm looking for a home, 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 looking for a home, I'm looking for a home. The farmer said to his missus, what do you think of that? Boll weevil's gone and ate a hole in my best Sunday hat. He's looking for a home, he's looking for a home. Farmer said to the merchant, I ain't made but one bale. For I'd give you that one, I'd fight and go to jail. I'll keep my home, I'll keep my home. Oh, the boll weevil's got half the cotton and the merchant's got the rest. Didn't leave the farmer's wife but one old cotton dress, and it's full of holes, and it's full of holes, it's full of holes, it's full of holes. Now if anyone should ask you, who was it made this song, tell him a poor old farmer, he done been here and gone. Ain't got no home, ain't got no home, ain't got no home, ain't got no home.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're coming down to the last minute of Highway 322 Special Edition. Thanks again to Jack Rummel for giving up an hour of his Ragtime America program so we can celebrate Pete Seeger's 100th birthday. Thanks again, Jack. And Jack will be on next week, ladies and gentlemen. So tune in at 8 o'clock again for the normal slot for Ragtime America. I'd like to give a big thanks for everybody that put everything together here. Silent Bear, Elena Claver, Fergus Stone, Dean Birkenkamp, David Amaran and Tinya Seeger, as well as Tom Morello. Thanks a lot, everybody, for all the effort here in celebrating Pete's birthday. My name's Will Two-Step. It's been my utmost pleasure. Stay tuned for, at 9 o'clock, Swing Shift with Tanya. This is KGNU Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins.
Support comes from the Five Points Jazz Festival, taking place Saturday, May 18th, in Denver's Five Points neighborhood. The festival celebrates the history of Five Points and features live jazz music, food, vendors, and more. More information at artsandvenuesdenver.com.
If you are a nonprofit organization with ongoing services or campaigns that you'd like to share with your fellow community members, please consider submitting a public service announcement to KGNU. Public service announcements are on-air, non-commercial announcements that help raise awareness about services and issues in our Front Range community. To submit a public service announcement for your nonprofit, please visit kgnu.org/psa.